Hello and welcome to our latest podcast series, Official Business, where myself, Vicky Highton, the founder of the Female Coaching Network, and Liliana Hora, the Women in Sport Manager at Athletics Ireland, interview a number of technical officials to not only learn about their own journey, but also what they feel needs to change in the world of officiating.
Lisa Ferdinand is an official from Canada who has a long and experienced career in athletics. Lisa began competing in 1974 and went on to represent Canada in the high jump both nationally and internationally. As well as high jump, Lisa also competed in the heptathlon and javelin. In 1988, unfortunately, an injury forced her to retire, and Lisa moved into officiating as a way to give back to athletics and remain connected to her sport. Lisa has now been a technical official, chief starter, start coordinator and referee for over 25 years. Earlier this year at the World Indoor Championships in Belgrade, Lisa became the first ever female starter at a World Champs. And I hope, Lisa, that introduction has done and made you feel good and proud of everything that you've achieved over the last little while.
That's fantastic. I should correct one thing about the first female starter at an international world championships. There are starters and have been female starters at a lot of these events. And my first actual position as an international starter is what it would have been. The difference is that the host countries will always have a team of starters that we work with. Yeah. So, for instance, when I did Belgrade, I worked with a group of starters that were national starters. The international starter is actually assigned to do specific events. So we will deal with the sprints, usually the 60 meters or 60 meter hurdles, outdoors 100 meters, 100 meter hurdles. So we're slightly different than an international technical official or an ITO in that we have a specific role to do, and we report to the technical delegate, and the technical delegate actually tells us what we will be doing, as opposed to an ITO who is a referee of an event. So there's a bit of difference in role. And I know we were going to discuss it a little later, but it is there is a distinction in what I do and my interaction with a group of starters at any championships.
Super. Sorry, the curiosity got the better of me, but
no, it's good. No, I should have sent you an email. I should have sent you a text or an email just to let you know I think Portland was one of the first times, Portland World Indoors, and then I did Birmingham as the international starter. But on that same team or on those at those competitions, there were also other female starters present at the championships and on the start team. Just so you know.
And because obviously you've done so much, but if we brought it back, Lisa, like to the very, very start, and the beginning of your officiating journey, how did it start and why did you become an official?
A lot of it was due to my involvement. I wanted to stay involved. So as you mentioned in the introduction, I did suffer an injury as an athlete, and it was a chronic injury which kept coming back. And at some point I had to decide what I was going to do. And when I chose to stop competing and start my professional career, I was asked if I would come back and officiate. And I gladly did that because I didn't even think about doing it at the time, to tell you the truth. It was someone had suggested it, and I'm glad they suggested it because it was the impetus for me to get involved. And it was a great way to stay connected with my former teammates, with my coaches, believe it or not, that I'd had over the years that you cross paths with. So it was a great way not only to give back, but also to stay involved in the athletics family.
Amazing. And obviously, like, we know the importance of an official and how vital your role is. But can you tell us a little bit more maybe about your role as a starter? Because obviously it holds immense responsibility, and unfortunately for the wrong reasons, it can come with a lot of criticism. And I can imagine that is very nerve-wracking, but how nerve-wracking is it to stand on those steps ready to pull the trigger at some of the most watched events at an athletics meet?
Actually, it's not as nerve-wracking as you might imagine. I think if I can go back and I learned something as I was starting out as a starter from one of my mentors, and he had taken me through the different stages. I think it was called is called the four stages of competencies. And as you learn something new, you go through different stages. And I found myself identifying with them and going through them. So when I first started out, it was, I didn't know what I didn't know. So it was an unconscious effort that I was doing. And I just didn't have any idea. And as I progressed, it became a conscious effort, but I still didn't have the competency, shall you say. So that's where I learned how to do what I was doing as a starter. Then as I progressed, I came to the point where I understood the rules, I knew how to administer them. And I was very conscientious about what I was doing, excuse me, my competency level. But there was also something in the background that you had to do things as a checklist. So as you develop your skill sets, you know that the starter's assistants are going to close the track. You know that you have to make sure that the finish line is ready, or photo finish, and the referees are ready at the finish line. There are a whole series of things, but your brain starts going through these things in order to do it. Where I learned, or where I transitioned into the last stage, which is where I am, it's unconscious competency. So I don't think about what I do. That sounds odd, but it just comes after so many years of experience. It just comes that you've done it so many times, so it becomes an unconscious effort. You know exactly what's going to do. You know what a good start feels like. You know what a bad start feels like. Although you may not see it may not have been a false start, but you have a sense that something was wrong, and that kind of came with a lot of experience. As I moved into that stage, There was one other stage I had to go through, which was dealing with ego. And I know that's probably something that a lot of officials may not talk about, but I went through it, and I know I had to deal with keeping the sense of ego. We have an immense amount of power when you're officiating. Forget just starting, just as an official, you can exercise a lot of authority. And I found myself having to ask myself why exactly I was here. And the simple answer is for the athletes. We're here as we facilitate a competition. And if we do our job properly, no one knows who we are. So getting back to your question about criticism and nerves, I'm not nervous when I get up on the stand. Criticism doesn't bother me. I know what I do and I know how to do it. And it's very easy to be criticized, but not someone not understanding what you're having to deal with in the moment, whether it's false starts, whether it's determining if an athlete who moved, because you're taking in a lot of information all at once, and you have to be able to render a decision within seconds. And sometimes that's easy. Sometimes it's not so easy. Sometimes you will, I can attest to that. Sometimes you make mistakes, and then you figure out how you improve upon that, and you try not to do that in the future. But again, as I said, a lot of these reactions are split second, and you have to be able to understand exactly what just transpired in front of you and how you administer the rules, which is why we're there. I think the you asked about being nervous. I'm not nervous on the stand, but I will tell you at the when you have a stadium full of 70,000 people and your voice cracks, that's when I get nervous. And that happened to me once, and I thought, oh gosh, it's just, I hope no one heard that. Well, of course, everybody heard that, including the athlete. So if anything, I try very hard to make sure that when I'm on the stand, that how I deliver my commands is very consistent. And if my voice is cracking, that is one thing that I work really hard at. And that is what I'm nervous at. I'm not nervous about actually administering my commands or dealing with the athletes. Another thing that I find that has helped me as an official in dealing with, I don't know, nerves is what it would be, but I've distanced myself from athletes. So I'm not the type of official who will interact with the athletes, who will go up and, you know, chat with them offline or chat with them as I'm, you know, going through an athlete zone. I find that it's, in order to be able to do my job as an athlete or as an official, that I need to be, I must remain impartial. And the way I find that I remain impartial is by not knowing who they are. They are, when they line up on the line, if Usain Bolt or Andre de Grasse or any number of world record holders are standing on the line, they are all the same. So they are, I'm there to start a race, and I'm there to administer the rules as per World Athletics. And
And Lisa, as you mentioned World Athletics there, I read a quote that you did with a recent interview with World Athletics, in which you said, you know, my choice of career in the mining industry as a geologist is a direct result of athletics. How did that come about? Can you tell us maybe what you meant here?
It was as a young athlete, I enjoyed competing, and I enjoyed training, and I found that there were a few key moments when I was training that I loved being outside. And what I mean by that is just the doing hurdle drills in the pouring rain, and not too many people enjoy something like that. But I'd always thought to myself, this is just a cool headspace. It's just a great feeling. You're out there and you're doing what you want to do, first of all, but you also enjoy what you're doing. And it didn't matter what setting it was in outdoors. Whether it was going for a run in, you know, we have a lot of snow here, so going for a run while it's snowing is a very relaxing and calming feeling. So for me, as I was going through high school and trying to figure out what I wanted to do, one of the things that was the impetus for me is whatever career I chose, it was going to be an outdoor, something I could do outdoor. And I didn't mean excuse me, going outside and doing something and coming back inside. I meant being outside constantly. So, you know, engineering, civil engineering, mining engineering, geology were things that I thought would be a great fit. And true to form, they were. I've enjoyed my career as a geologist, and I've worked all over the world and done a lot of assessment work and exploration outdoors, lived outdoors, lived in tents, lived in fly camps. So it was a great sort of prelude to what I was going to do. So yeah, that's how I ended up in a mining career.
I love that connection with the outdoors. Reading that on paper, when I read that, I thought, I can't put together athletics and what you were doing in the mining industry, but I completely get the being outdoors connection. Mm. Elisa, you'll know more than anyone being an official that sometimes it can be a very thankless job, something that we've chatted about with some of the other officials that we've been interviewing. What are some of the hardest challenges for you, you know, with in terms of how long hours they are, how many days, especially at a major championships, being at weekends or lack of breaks? And do you think that the organising committees take into consideration the welfare of officials enough?
I think that when it comes to the organising committees, I think there are many factors that go into organising a meet. We've got, you know, facility time, facility rental. You've got schedules that are usually created well in advance. And then you have the added complication of entries. And if you hadn't budgeted for a certain number of entries, then you get your schedule is bloated. So there are multiple reasons for long hours for officials. Are they manageable? I think that one of the things that can happen or should happen, and I know it's happening with us in our area or our association, is that we have officials that actually sit with our meet directors, or we're moving to that stage. Our, at least our provincial meet directors, to go through the schedules with them, because they're the ones who actually have to source the officials. And if they're able to source enough officials to meet with the demands of the competition, then it becomes an exercise in coordinating and organization, I think. I think there are a lot of meet directors who are new, they're a new club, and that they are they're wanting to put on a competition, which is awesome. We need lots of competitions for our athletes. But I think what happens is they're not aware of all of the components that go into the making of it, and all of the things that actually can contribute to prolonged meet schedules, to a lack of breaks for officials. And I don't think that it's intentional. I think that it just is a lack of, in some cases, understanding, and then in other cases, just a sheer. The issue is dealing with constraints that they may not have thought about. So, as I said, whether it be some facilities that you can only have for a certain amount of time, excuse me. For a certain amount of time, so they'll try and cram in an event when it's not possible, or someone on paper has a great idea that, you know, we're going to run the long jump and we'll run this age group, and immediately following that we'll have another age group run right after it. On paper, that's great as far as efficiencies, but I don't think they understand that the resources in order to go through and do that may be lacking, or they may not have contemplated it. So I think that's where that comes from, personally. Can we do things about it? I think we can. Officials, I don't think are unreasonable in looking for a break here and there. And I think as time has gone on, it is becoming a bigger issue, and people are paying attention and learning about it. And I should say that this type of thing, it depends on what level of meet you're dealing with as well. And I think you mentioned grassroots. At the grassroots level is where you tend to get things like this. That said, I mean, our championships, our provincial championships, so in our region, we have challenges sometimes, and those are usually spurred on by the number of entries that we receive. And again, schedules are built and things are done well in advance, but after you've got entries, and if it's close enough to the competition and you're not able to secure officials, then that's where you sort of compound the issue. So my thoughts on that are better communication, making sure that we have the individuals who are dealing with the officials who are coordinating them, who can deal directly with the meet directors and deal with them at the various stages when they're building the competition meet, when they are, or after they've submitted it, to provide input on the competition itself, and to be realistic about what's possible and what's not, because I can assure you that as officials, we understand how long it takes to do an event. So, you know, doing a pole vault with three people and you know, budgeting maybe an hour for that at a younger age group is one thing. But when you try and, excuse me, because you've run out of time and you're going to combine two pole vaults, for example, and you're now looking at, you know, 20 something athletes, you're looking at like 5 hours of competition. So it's just understanding how long it's going to take to do an event and what's realistic. So my thoughts are better dialogue with the people who are organizing, better understanding for meet directors to be able to one, not only build a schedule, but take into account the other factors which play into things like that. But I don't think that it's something that's intentional. Mm-hmm. I think it's something that just sort of plays out meet after meet sometimes, and people aren't speaking up, and people need to work on efficiencies.
I wanted to ask you, Lisa, about the diversity of our sport, because whilst we are one of the very few sports, perhaps similar to in the way of tennis, where athletes are 50-50 male, female, and from all different backgrounds, one of the things that does lack in our sport is a diversity of leadership, coaching, officiating, etc. And you've been a bit of a trailblazer throughout your career. Am I right in saying you were the first woman on the World Athletics Starter Panel, yes, and also the first person of colour to serve as a board chair on your local association? Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts on the lack of diversity at leadership, officiating and coaching? Is it something you've been aware of? And, you know, what do you think the reasons are behind that?
I think that with regards to diversity, I think that we as a sport, for officials, there's a pretty good representation for males and females. We typically over the years, I've looked at some stats, we've had roughly a 60-40, or for every six males, there are four females who are officiating, which is good. I'd like to see that higher over the next, you know, a little while as we move to a 50-50 inclusive sport. As far as you know, looking at what the issues are or what can be done about that, I think the first thing we have to do is decide what we want our sport to look like. And I think that World Athletics has done that. We are equally represented on the field with regards to athletes and the number of events that are out there. They are looking at increasing the number of administrative roles or positions on council, as well as in coaching as well. So there is a push, but I think the biggest thing is we need to think about what do we want that to look like, and if we can have the conversation about that continuously, I think people will start to understand, and I think they already are starting to understand some of the barriers to entry for women. For myself, I remember I have three children, and my children grew up at the track. And one of the things that I found that was challenging when my husband was traveling with work is that I wanted to do competitions, but I didn't necessarily have I couldn't necessarily, I had time to do it with the kids. So my drive to do this was that I would always have a babysitter. So I would hire a babysitter and bring them to the track, and they would look after the kids in the, you know, the long jump pit or wherever, outdoors. Mainly indoors was a little bit more challenging, but we always managed. And if I can, I have a funny story about that with our my oldest daughter, who's now 30 something. So when she was 3 or 4, I again had the babysitter, and I was at a track. I think it might have been a provincial championships, so a local meet, and I was on the start stand, and as I was getting ready to give the commands or pull the trigger, give the first command, on your marks, the race was stopped. One of the starter's assistants stopped the race and started waving to me to hold up the race. And I was kind of perplexed, and I'm looking at them like, what's going on? Why are you aborting the start? And all they did was they pointed. And when they pointed, I could see my daughter in lane 8 on her tricycle coming around the corner, barreling towards mummy. And we thought that was hilarious. But I think that was a little anecdote, but I think it's important that we understand some of the barriers that women face. And one of them is childcare. You know, what we do about that. I mean, potentially, you know, providing daycare service, or providing co-ops for officials to drop their kids off if they need to. I think as far as diversity is providing a safe and welcoming environment. I think it's not easy for a lot of individuals to come to. They've seen the sport, they enjoy it, and they'd like to come out and do it. But some of them may feel intimidated. Some of them are for the first time looking at how do they put themselves out there. And I think we as a sport need to be very welcoming and need to make sure that they are they're welcome. They're assured that, you know, no one's going to, you know. What I mean by safe is just treated properly. Is just, you know, you're here to do the same thing I'm doing. So you should be treated with respect, you should be welcomed, and you should be offered the same types of opportunities as everyone else. And I think that's important. I think that we just in general, we should expect and demand higher standards as far as what people hold themselves out to be, how they treat others, and I think that is a component of a welcoming environment. Does that answer the question about diversity? I think making it easier for people to participate and understanding what types of things they need would go a long, long way. I know we haven't touched on it, but I think my comment about we should expect and demand higher standards. I think marginalizing behavior is something that's always that has always been at least present and can be a deterrent. So it's how we deal with that marginalizing behavior when we talk about whether it's women or minorities, regardless. But certain practices or certain behaviors need to be addressed, and they need to be dealt with in a serious manner. I think, you know, zero tolerance is what you want. Jokes and, you know, belittling and various other things like this, they need to be kept in check, and people need to be held accountable for that. And I think that's something that continues to be not a huge concern, but it's there. It's there under the surface. And I think collectively, we can, as a group, male and female, can and should demand more from everyone. And I'm not referring to just officiating, but just in general as humans. And I think that would go a long way to helping people feel comfortable in taking on a role such as officiating in this case.
Of course, yeah, and so it should be. So just last couple of questions from me then, Lisa, is if you could make one rule change in the sport on a global level, what would that be and why?
Actually, this one was quite easy because World Athletics just brought in a sanctioning policy, a competition sanctioning policy, which I thought was fantastic. For years, I had wanted something like that. And not thinking about World Athletics per se, but our local association or our region in dealing with the standard or the level of meets. There were, and I know Twilight meets or all comers meets where standards were being made, yet there were rules that weren't necessarily being adhered to, whether it be the number of umpires on the track, for instance, or umpires able to actually view whether or not athletes were in their lanes for 200 meters on the curve or 400 meters. In the absence of all of these, athletes could have created infractions which would have disallowed their performances, but that hasn't been the case. So I'm really excited, believe it or not, about this rule, because it does bring some level of standardization and it does bring some responsibility to meet directors to ensure that they are sufficiently staffed with the resources they need to make sure these meets and these performances are conducted according to World Athletics rules. So that was hands down for me something that I would have wanted and I've always wanted to have happen. So it's happened.
Right, brilliant. And I just have one more, which I didn't actually email you about, but I was wondering if, like, have you been part of any communities or networks that you've been involved with that have helped you benefit and develop as an official over the years?
A lot of my development has been with connecting with individuals who are starters. So for me, I've benefited from having mentors, and I've been quite fortunate. And oddly enough, I mean, they've all been males, and they have all been very supportive in what I do and how I've developed over the years. So a lot of my connections and my development have been with these individuals and with other like-minded individuals in our sport. So internationally, we have a group of officials who keep in contact and who will discuss things when there's a false start that's transpired, analyzing what actually has gone on and providing feedback to one another, because that's how I've learned over the years. As far as an official network, I haven't been part of an official network per se. I think that there have been, we do workshops, a lot of workshops in Canada. We do a lot of online discussion groups that provide either information to other starters, or we have conversations about things that have happened in the past so we can actually learn from them. So on the other side, just in general networking, we do have a network I've always had a network of individuals that I've stayed in contact with over the years, again, from athletics, who bring a perspective to what I do. And I know that that's probably not the network you're thinking of. It's more of a personal network, not a public network, but it's important, I think, for any official to reach out to other individuals or other technical officials wherever they've come across them, whether it be at an international meet or a local meet, or in Canada, we're quite a large country, so we have individuals spread out over quite a vast, well, 4 or 5 time zones. So there's lots to choose from as far as distance, but staying in contact with individuals and creating your own networks is a lot of what I've done over the years.
Thank you so much, Lisa, for your time. Thank you for sharing your story and your insights into the world of officiating. Really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much, Lisa. You're very grateful.
No worries. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. Enjoy the rest of your day. Speak soon.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.